Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, joins us for the weekly update every single Friday morning. And it sounds like, based on my conversation with Mr. Honlein, he is in snowbound Brooklyn, New York this morning. Malcolm Honlein, welcome back to JM in the AM.
Neither rain nor snow nor sleet will keep you from your appointed round.
Wow, we should coin that. We should trademark that.
I hope people appreciate what it means for you to have had slept in at your usual ungodly hour.
Well, I thank you for that, Mr. Honlein. Keep pouring it on. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Satisfy my radio curiosity. I would assume you at some point were a guest of Bob Grant on his radio show.
Absolutely. He was, for those who don't remember, he was a pioneer in what became talk radio, I guess, but also
sure.
In the conservative-oriented talk radio in particular. So he was, and he was always very staunchly pro-Israel. As I remember.
Yeah, were there any tough conversations with him? I mean, did you ever get into any? Because even though he was pro-Israel, as you described, there were always nuances that irritated him about certain things in the Israeli political community.
Yes, we had sometimes contentious discussions about it. But, you know, you just couldn't take that too seriously because, you know, he would pop off about something. And as you said, sometimes it would upset people,
right.
But fundamentally he was sympathetic and on the right side.
A topic of the week seems to be the health of the prime ministers. Let's start with Benjamin Netanyahu. He had a polyp removed from his intestine. What's the update regarding his health this week?
No, he's fine. He did have an episode where he was hospitalized for an hour or two. He went to the hospital, actually, just for minor ailments, a bad cold, whatever, and then he had his routine medical examination, which is required every year of the prime minister, and I think the president as well, and he's fine.
And the former prime minister Ariel Sharon, it's been 8 years since his stroke. What is the latest that you've heard regarding his situation?
Well, primarily that he continues to confound the doctors and the experts regarding his condition. He's deteriorated a great deal over the last 24 hours, even more. And in the last couple of hours, it seems that, as they said, he is slipping towards death.
All right, so that's the story, and nothing unexpected there. The United States actually has the mechanism or mechanisms or whatever system there is that you could describe to us on a ship near Syria that could destroy Syrian chemical weapons?
Yes, they are able to dispose of it in deep water where the feeling is that it will not pose any kind of environmental damage. The question was getting the stuff out of Syria because of the civil war. It was hard to move it. And the Russians provided these armored vehicles that were to pick up the stuff, take it to the port where it was to be shipped originally, I think, through Italy and then onto American ships. Nobody wanted to take it. And as you know, they wanted to dispose of it in different countries, Albania being one of them, and all of them ultimately rejected it. So the shipboard disposal was the only option really open.
So this is what, chemical weapons that had been confiscated already?
These are the chemical weapons that have been confiscated and that have to be disposed of because as long as they're in a country, they're subject to use or abuse and being picked up by other parties. So it's really important that they actually be destroyed. And there are still facilities that are still in those areas, not much. Most of them have been dismantled, but they have been stopped, but they also have to be completely dismantled. So there's still work to be done, but the primary objective now is to get rid of the chemical weapons.
Hezbollah continues to move long-range missiles from Syria to Lebanon. And it's not just those. There are other weaponry is also being moved on a constant basis. If this is happening on a constant basis, and from what you've told us, it seems like it's a revolving door and never stops happening, why did it make headlines this week?
Well, because of a study that was done in the exposure that it's not just missiles, but other strategically important weapons, technologically advanced weapons and systems that have been sent via Syria and directly from Iran, which is a violation because you're providing it to a terrorist organization, i.e. Hezbollah, is against international law. The concern, of course, is that there are tens of thousands, many tens of thousands of rockets, some estimate as much as 100,000. And you know that people building houses in southern Lebanon are required to have a rocket room as well as a living room, bedroom, and kitchen.
Right.
And they get compensation for that. But that also protects them, they believe, because they know Israel is reluctant or won't bomb civilian locations. However, that is no longer true, and that Israel's response will have to be a very strong and broad-based one. The limitations imposed last time, because Hezbollah was not part of the government, and therefore they didn't want to hit official infrastructure. Now that Hezbollah is the government, those restrictions would no longer apply. The build-up there is of concern on a number of grounds. First of all, of course, regarding any potential conflict with Israel, but also because of the internal conflict that is raging in Lebanon. I mean, we're heading towards a civil war. The war in Syria has been transposed into Lebanon. In the north of Lebanon, you've had ongoing elements of a civil war. But now with the bombings that took place, with the tit-for-tat bombings, and I think you can safely predict that it isn't over. The last one was a Sunni payback to Hezbollah for the one last week earlier in the week where a minister was killed, a Lebanese minister who had opposed Assad, and it's not the first of these either. Some of them, as I said, targeting Hezbollah operations, and some of them targeting general population. Lebanon has always been a very tenuous balance, and they've had civil wars before. Remember the Palestinian one. So this is not an idle threat. And when you have a million refugees, and when you have this constant inflow of weapons, and the other terrorist organizations that use Lebanon to come back to escape the fighting in Syria, for R&R, for regrouping, that only compounds it. But there's also a lot of disappointment in Lebanon and anger that about the losses that Hezbollah has suffered, the families protesting, because they said, you know, it was created to fight Israel, not to fight other Arabs. So it's a very delicate situation.
So who took responsibility for this week's bombing, Beirut bombing?
This was done by the Sunni groups.
And where do they fall again in terms of the Assad government?
These are the anti-Assad
government.
Forces.
And it's now 2014. The threat to Israel, I mean, it's been not long enough, but it's been a while since there was a full-scale attack up north against Israel. Is there any, I mean, I understand the difference in terms of what's happening in Lebanon itself, and the civil war would call for more unrest and a more unsettling situation there. But does that mean that Israel is more threatened than it was a couple of years back?
From Lebanon?
Yeah.
It's a combination of factors. Israel is threatened by Hezbollah because Hezbollah is an arm of Iran. And as a terrorist organization, they can't defeat Israel, but they can do tremendous amount of damage. Hezbollah is designated a terrorist organization by most of the civilized world, and yet you see that they continue to supply them with weapons and the wherewithal to continue the terrorist activities and expand it. But now they also have battle-tested troops. It is a significant difference in terms of terrorists who have trained in the field or have been trained in other countries, but now to have troops who have actually been fighting, who've killed, who were in fighting Syrian troops.
They've upgraded their military personnel, basically.
Their profile, yes.
Yeah. They did hit Kiryat Shmona this week with a long-range missile?
They hit near Kiryat Shmona. They didn't hit, and there were no casualties in the bombing. But, again, it's an escalation, and they keep trying to say that this is, look, a lone individual, that the government went after them. They did arrest people responsible for the attack last week. But, you know, Israel can't tolerate these cross-border raids. They're going to have to respond at some point, and the response is going to have to be very tough.
And while we're on the subject of bombings, let's do this section of my list. Who's responsible for the bombing that killed the PA ambassador to the Czech Republic in Prague?
The Czech ambassador in Prague. What he did is he opened a safe that had been closed for 20 years or something, and it was obviously booby-trapped, and it exploded when he opened it.
Yeah, but booby-trapped set 20 years ago or booby-trapped sent 20 minutes before?
No, it looks like this was set a long time ago. Nobody had opened it for many years, and he's only been there a couple of years. So I think that this was, I mean, there's no real reason for Israel or anybody else to booby-trap the Czech ambassador.
And who, Czech ambassador, it's a PA ambassador to Czech or to the Czech Republic? Is that how it works?
He is the PA representative, yeah.
To the Czech Republic.
And recognize it most countries.
Right, understood. And in Volgograd, Russia, the second suicide bombing, who's responsible for those?
This is very important because this is an escalating situation, and you have to look at the general situation in Russia internally, because this is a development in the heartland of Russia. And it has to be seen in two contexts. One is the general population shift. The population of Russia is declining. It's the estimate, the projections are that it'll be down to perhaps 100 million from 140 million. But the Russian, the Islamic population will be 1 in 5.
Wow.
And increasing. Their birth rates are going up. The Russian birth rate is going down dramatically. This bombing, which is 400 miles, Volgograd, is 400 miles from Sochi. From Sochi.
Pays to be a sports fan.
I was getting hungry. I knew it was sushi. Wasn't. No, from Sochi, which is where the Olympics are going to begin in early February. So you have this site. If you remember, in April of 2009, Putin publicly stated that the government's war against the radical Islamists was a, quote, mission accomplished. And now you've staged this a really savage comeback, but because it's not just this one bombing. You've had several just in recent weeks, two in Volgograd. And there's a thing called the Caucasus Emirate, which is a terrorist operation. And the so-called imam of it has talked about his goal of liberation of the Caucasus, and they are trying to destroy the Olympics as a target, as one of the ways of striking. And you have this in areas like Tatarstan and Bashkortostan, which are both Muslim republics near the Ural Mountains, and in other areas as well. So this is, I think, something that is going to be with us. I think Putin will obviously not spare anything in his response to it, but we'll see whether it escalates and what impact it has on the participation in Sochi.
Well, I mean, it's not going to, I would assume, no country is threatening not to come at this point because of security concerns, right?
Well, I'm talking about the people
who attend the games
and coming. It's not the governmental thing. I know President Obama is not going. Some have boycotted it because of the anti-gay positions, the legislation that they took, and some other positions that have been adopted.
So the question is, will it keep the crowds away? Is what you're saying?
Exactly.
I mean, is it possible? I mean, we know from the experience here, thank God, that it seems that it's possible to actually, you know, have the intelligence and the personnel to secure an area you know, especially if done with due diligence. Can they do that there? I mean, do they have the wherewithal to prevent these types of bombings during a couple of weeks of the Olympic Games?
I think that they have the capacity to protect Sochi and to, within reasonable limits. I mean, there's no way that
right.
you can hermetically seal an area that big. And but the Russian internal system, as you see from the arrests of his political opponents and of other people, is still very much the KGB of old. And I can assure you that it'll be very hard for anybody to move without being detected.
Well, you're not going to be traveling there in the near future, I can tell you that much.
I don't think so.
America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning radio program, heard on listeners sponsored WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, Rockland County at 91.9 on the FM dial, and around the world on the web, jmnam.org. Malcolm Honlein is with us. He's Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. How are the numbers going in terms of universities who have joined your call to not fall prey to the academic boycott of Israel?
Well, this is based on the action of the American Studies Association, and as you know, we said we had to draw the line and saying you have to say no more. It had to be done, and this was the time to do it. So far, more than 100 university presidents have come out strongly in response to our request, but these are presidents from Princeton, Harvard, Yale, to universities across the country, plus the major university organizations, and the land-grant universities just last night came out with a statement, and many of the presidents are still away, and their offices were closed, so we anticipate that the number will continue to rise, and this is especially important because soon there's going to be the Modern Languages Association, where they have a one-sided panel scheduled on BDS and boycotting Israeli institutions, and I have no doubt that someone will attempt a resolution there. But I hope that the message of the universities, and that people should go to our website and read some of the statements. These are not just simple declarations in many cases against saying that a boycott isn't nice and against the ASA decision, but a real sharp denunciation of the practice and of people reaffirming, and in some cases even saying that they will go further with their ties with Israel as a demonstrative act. So the as of yesterday, the number was, each time we would put out an update, by the time we got it out, it was already out of date because the number has, thank God, increased rapidly. And I think that this could be a turning point. It'll be a message to all those who are going to try to push this about the price you could pay by engaging in this practice.
And by the way, for some of the younger people in this audience, I'd love for you to emphasize how it doesn't always go this way. You know, some people might think, especially among the younger people, that that these types of battles go as easily as this one's going. You can attest to the fact that it's not always this simple to get university heads or whatever the category may be of people to come out and make strong statements.
Absolutely, and I think Larry Summers' comment, the former president of Harvard, former secretary of the Treasury, helped us in that regard when he came out publicly. But if you look at the story in the Times this week where they made a reference to the ASA decision in the context of the story about Swarthmore and the debate over the Hillel there, inviting BDS proponents, primarily that was the issue, you see that they make a simple reference to the ASA and say that they voted to boycott Israel without one word about the overwhelming opposition amongst its members and the fact that only 16% of the members voted in favor of the resolution, but it was enough. So the lesson is, one, absolutely not to take these things for granted. Don't believe that, but two, to recognize the voice we have and how many allies we have out there if we are out front on these issues. And don't just sweep it under the rug or believe it's not important. It is important.
1 second. Now that you've brought up Swarthmore, 16% of that?
No, of the ASA membership, because they have 5,000 members, they claim, individual members.
Ah.
And of those, only 3,000-something were eligible. And of those, you had needed two-thirds vote.
Understood.
So in the end, it was really 16% of the total membership that they claimed.
Understood. But on Swarthmore, what percentage of the Hillel actually wanted to open its doors?
Well, they say that they have a majority of the students, but that's not a real election.
I read election,
but they did decide that they wanted to, you know, they do it under the guise of free speech,
right?
Which this is not. Nobody's arguing about free speech. What they're arguing is whether a Jewish institution funded by the Jewish community has an obligation to put on people who engage in BDS. It's not criticism of an Israeli policy. It's those who deny Israel's right to exist.
100%. In general, I saw someone make the point that if you're going to open up the doors to everybody, including even more so greater enemies of Israel, what's the point of Hillel to begin with, or any organization that wants to be identifiably Jewish? I mean, just like other organizations that have a certain political bent or a certain desire to associate with their own socially, why would they go ahead and open up their doors to everybody in certain circumstances? It just doesn't make any sense.
And that has nothing to do with having diversity of
right.
views and
exactly.
people who have...
exactly.
And being open to the students. It's not a question of blocking out students. It's a question of people being invited who are openly hostile to Israel.
Let's go back now to Israel and try to understand what's happening with this peace process, and I apologize for laughing. There is an announcement, supposedly, of new housing in Israel, I assume in some disputed areas, that has been postponed because John Kerry is now in the country. Do you know what that announcement is scheduled to be?
I mean, I have seen references to it, but you never know till it actually comes out, but it was to have been... again, this is not actual construction.
Understood.
It's zoning.
But I'm not even talking about whether it's actual construction or not. Wouldn't it be a better idea not to release the information that there was going to be an announcement, but now there will not be one because John Kerry is there? Isn't it better just not to say anything regarding this?
Well, that's true in regard to many things that happened there, but... I happen to agree. I think if you're going to do it, just
we're going to make an announcement about why we're not making an announcement.
And then each issue, and the point I was making before was that it's not the actual construction. These are usually zoning decisions or approvals that will take years to implement, and the price that is paid for no result is ridiculous. So. Whether it's meant to balance the release of prisoners, of terrorists, which evoke increasing reaction from the people, from the Israeli people,
yep.
If meant to offset that, it's just the point is just do and don't talk. But each time you make a reference like this, that encouraged then the international community
right.
to come down on them.
So with that in mind, do you talk when you're the prime minister and you have this burning desire to question the Palestinian Authority's commitment to peace in front of the peace broker, John Kerry? Is that a good idea, to get up and question whether the PA really is sincere about this peace effort?
I think that the Prime Minister was absolutely appropriate in raising the blatant incitement that the PA engages in, including Abbas, and the way that he welcomed the terrorists who were released, making them heroes. What Netanyahu was pointing out is that you don't see the denunciation of the acts conducted by these people. Rather, they get pensions and then get this big hero's welcome. Now, some people can raise the question, why do you release these guys if in fact that's your concern?
Uh-huh.
But I think the criticism that he was leveling is one that the United States, others have said as well. You can't keep shifting the onus. And if you look at the PA statements, how they're trying to renege, they try to preempt the issues, like the Jordan Valley issue, which many people don't understand why it is so significant, or they've tried to take each of the issues, even the talk of the land swap. The Israeli Arabs living there are opposing it, let alone the others. But you've seen it in regard to a number of the key issues, where the PA is preempting the discussions. Now, what Kerry is trying to do is trying to come with, they call a framework, a FAPS, a framework agreement, rather than, which is supposed to lead to a CAPS, which is a comprehensive agreement. This is only really to be the basis for continuation of talks. But when the PA is allowing this this increasing level of violence, which is escalating out of control right now, and we talked about the numbers, how it's doubled over the last 3-4 months. The last count was, I think, 167 in November, and increasing numbers in December, too. Then you have, of course, Hamas denouncing it and saying Abbas has no right to represent us. This is Kerry's 10th trip. In addition, you've had 20 sessions of the Palestinian-Israeli discussion. So his goal is to try and bridge some of the differences to be able to say something, have a framework for further talks that both sides can agree with, but each side will express their reservations or differences in this regard. But I think it is important for because the international press always puts the onus strictly on Israel. And the Israel is the one that lived up to its commitments, and the Palestinians, who had said that incitement doesn't exist, et cetera, et cetera. And incitement is critical. It's so important. It's when the poisoning of the minds, the increased actions of violence are a result of it.
It's just, you just never know with the prime minister, though, what type of strategy he's using. There's so many times where he'll acquiesce and, you know, and seem as if he's ready to make an agreement at any cost and talk about how Israel will do that at any cost. And, you know, the next day he's talking about, well, you know, I don't have a legitimate peace partner. I question their commitment to this peace process. Like, just don't know where he's coming from.
Well, one of the points that, you know, it's very easy for all of us who sit outside and don't have to deal with the day-to-day realities that that he faces. There are a lot of international pressures, and these affect Israel's economy. It affects Israel's security. And I think he doesn't want Israel to be painted as the obstinate party. So he's trying to present a more balanced assessment by his state, an honest assessment of the realities of what's happening on the ground. But, you know, there are a lot of pressures. You see that the Dutch boycott movements, other things, major companies pulling out of Israel, et cetera. And what he said was that Abbas has essentially embraced these terrorists as heroes. He sets an example for what young people in the Palestinian Authority areas see, and even when they were Palestinian security forces people, he said they didn't denounce it. So I think he's trying to put in stark relief that it's not Israel that's the
opposite. Oh, I'm not disagreeing with what he says. I just
no, I agree. I understand what you're saying, and I'm trying to put myself in his mindset and facing some of the issues and considerations that he has when he makes a public statement.
So what's the Kerry theme song? Turn your FAP into a cap? Is that what he basically is trying to do?
He right now would be very happy to get the FAPs going.
From FAP, we got to get it to cap ASAP, because I can't take all this shuttling back and forth to Jerusalem. By the way, I know I ask you this every week over the last couple of weeks, but again it hits the news as part of all this with John Kerry. Was Jonathan Pollard involved, or not involved, but was his release a factor in these negotiations this week or not?
It was raised. I know the Prime Minister has raised it repeatedly. There was a statement by Kerry, but that was his own individual reaction. I have not seen anything, as I said, I think 2 weeks ago when this first came up, anything on the ground. We continue to press for it. We continue to talk to people in the administration, but I think it'll have to be in some context. Prisoner release was one possibility. Maybe these FAPs will be another, and that this is something that they're holding out for Israel. But it's each day, it's just a greater injustice.
The only good thing, by the way, and I agree with you, or at least you've convinced me that it's a bad idea to link this to the process, to the Pollard release. But for the first time in a long time, Pollard remains in the headlines after the 1st of January, because usually, of course, these pardons and clemencies are granted before the end of the year. Once January 1st hits, you know, everybody hits reset, basically. Here it's remained as a top news story, even after the first of the year.
But the reason, and people should understand, if the peace process collapses, that should not stop Jonathan Pollard from being released.
That's
a matter of justice.
Yeah, no question about it. Why do I keep hearing Jordan Valley now in terms of... I never heard the Jordan Valley be an issue in regard to the peace process. All of a sudden, I hear that members of Knesset are demanding that Israel take action to secure the Jordan Valley. And I don't just mean secure in terms of security, but secure that it remain in Israel's hands forever.
Well, the security will remain in Israel's hands forever, and it's especially about the border locations. For one thing, this is what Jordan wants. For another thing, it's what Israel must have. And the United States backs the position. If you remember, this goes back decades to the Alon plan, to other plans which were proposed, which would have enabled Israel to retain at least security control. We have to remember that the release of this area that they're talking about to the Palestinians means that 70% of Israel's population is vulnerable, 80% of its industrial infrastructure vulnerable to attack, because it's all along that narrow coastal plain. And it could be easily controlled by the hills of the West Bank. In addition, you have other things now. You have 1.2 million Syrian refugees in Jordan. They're bringing the Iraqis, the Iranians, up to the Israeli border if you allow them to the Palestinians and their non-control of the borders, and Israel doesn't trust the international forces. The history in that regard has not been so great. And this, they say, is part of what President Bush promised in his letter of recognition in 2004 about secure, defensible borders and to preserve Israel's capacity to deter and defend itself. This is by itself. This is essential, and the military across the board, I think, hold to this view, and that it has to have an anti-terrorism buffer. And the King of Jordan, by the way, has been very clear on this issue as well. And there's no technology that can replace the human presence, Bogi Yalom said this week, the Minister of Defense. And it's, this is Israel's eastern security boundary, and therefore very important and very essential that Israel hold to this, and the Palestinians, of course, have already rejected it.
So even though Israel's neighbors agree with Israel that they should maintain control, they're still making it an issue.
Look at the increased terrorism we have now. Look at the flow of weapons and other things that, unless Israel really has full control and able to maybe define period, I think the next 1,000 years would be good, but maybe even 100, but which has been proposed. But for the immediate future, it's absolutely essential.
Finally, there's a new administration in New York City. You've been very complimentary of Ray Kelly, the former police commissioner, and his ability to lead a real anti-terrorism task force. Any reason to believe that the new police commissioner will not be able to maintain the level that the NYPD has had in this area?
Well, there's no reason to believe he can't. He's very capable. He's experienced. He served in Boston, L.A., New York. He's somebody who's very smart and, I think, committed to it. He may do things in a different way, but if we look at the infrastructure that the NYPD has on counterterrorism, I mean, it's really the lead in the world, and the should be sustained, and you'll see some new people brought in. But I think that, and I've discussed this with Mr. Bratton, I think he is very committed to this and has a clear understanding of these issues. And by the way, we should also note that Israel's population crossed the 8 million mark, 8.13 million people, which is a milestone.
Where'd the Russian 40 million go?
40 million?
Yeah, you said it went from 140 to 100.
No, it's just the decline in the birth rate.
One second. With the population of Russia, was it one time 140?
It is, and I'm saying it's declining to 100 because of the birth rate among
Russians.
Oh, and
when is that expected? When will it hit 100?
It will. I think the projection was over the next 10 years, if I remember correctly.
That's a pretty rapid decline.
It's a very rapid decline, but it's been ongoing. And the percentage of Muslims in the army and in other elements has increased. And there is a radicalization of the population that has been of great concern as well. So the internal situation in Russia, and then you have the economic problems and other things that compound it.
Where are you next week? Are you going to be speaking to us from Israel?
God willing, we'll be talking from Israel of 8 million people. And
I have three words for you.
I think a lot warmer than New York.
I have three words for you. Take a shovel. You'll be the hero of the land.
Bags of salt.
If it happens again.
Those cases, just salt. Listen, I think that, God willing, you know, things will be quiet in that respect.
Oh, it's what you think.
The weather, but I know it's been quite warm these days. It's getting cooler again. I just wanted to say one other thing on BDS, which is, I think, important. When this week there was a debate, a lot of exposure about this new Nazi salute.
Because of Tony Parker of the San Antonio Spurs.
Right, who has apologized for it, but then it turns out that many other European athletes have been doing it. But the Dutch BDS movement now has a portrayal of Anne Frank in a kaftia on their website and as a symbol. So people understand that this is really its core anti-Semitism. They legitimate it by being anti-Israel, but nobody should be fooled. And it's why everybody has to be involved. Everybody has to understand how serious. When we've talked about a lot of the issues, we didn't get to Turkey, which is exploding. We didn't get to the situation in Egypt where the crackdown on Muslim Brotherhood and the many arrests, and also the suicide bombings that took place in Gaza and the fighting along Israel's border with Hamas, and the fact that they actually have caught, the Egyptians have caught some of the terrorists over the past week, and Erdogan is facing a situation of internal collapse. At the same time, we see the further radicalization and the internal split between him and Gulen. So we could talk about that, those things next week. But the overall situation is today. It's a very it's a shifting world. There are 2014 is certainly unpredictable in terms of what direction a lot of these things will take. But what is not unpredictable is what we have to do. And I hope people will take this finally seriously and understand that when we talk about BDS, these are not initials. This is a campaign against the Jewish people and the Jewish state.
Excellent, Malcolm. Next week from Jerusalem. Thank you so much. Have a wonderful Shabbos.
Good Shabbos.
Malcolm Hohnlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations.